Okay.
Welcome one and all once again to Dual Wielding episode 56. If you haven't noticed, we still haven't done episode 54, but I assume that will come at some point, even though it'll be 2 weeks old by the time it does go up, if it comes up this week. This week we have a smaller group. It's a very busy weekend. It's actually Anthony's birthday by the time this comes up. Chad is busy with a StarCraft tournament. I think Jason is still crying about his 49ers losing last week to the Giants.
We didn't say that.
Yeah, he doesn't want to be reminded of that, so sorry if you're listening to this, Jason. And Adrian's just got like 50 things on his plate right now, so he's God knows where. But we do have Daniel.
Hello.
And joining us once again, I think this is like the fourth or fifth time, we have Adam Scheer.
Thanks.
And just like every time he joins us, I think you're on like 15 new websites.
Yep. It's all constantly changing. Right now, I am the host of the PlayStation Invasion, host and co-producer of the PlayStation Invasion podcast, which we're working with now. Second Opinion Productions will be on shifted2u.com, shifted2u.com. And then I'm also the managing editor of triptronictech.com, a nice tech site. We don't have much. We've had a lot considering we were just at CES. We have a lot of articles. We kind of stopped because we're busy with school, but we're going to try to get more out soon. And now I'm the newest contributor on levelsave.com, which is another awesome gaming site, which I'm slowly getting started with, but I'm very excited for that as well.
Okay, and you mentioned Triptronic and your trip to CES, and at CES you got to go hands-on with the two new consoles that we officially know are coming out this year. I mean, there's been rumors about the next Xbox coming out this year, but the Wii U and the PlayStation Vita.
Yep.
So do you want to share your impressions on those two?
Sure, I will. So I got hands-on. First I'll talk about the PlayStation Vita. I got my hands on the PlayStation Vita a couple of times. One time was at this event called PepCom, which was, it's not associated with the CEA or CES, but it's this other event that took place in the MGM Grand. There I just got to hold the system, kind of go through the home menu, play one little game from Little Deviants. But the system itself, it feels very light. It's pretty big, so it's not necessarily pocketable, but it definitely is portable. You could put it easily in a pocket of a backpack or something. Again, I was surprised by how light it was. It feels really smooth, really good in the hands. The dual analog sticks, they're smaller than I thought, but they are actual sticks. They don't click, though. I for some reason, I assume they would click like an L3 or an R3, but no, they don't. That's still okay.
I would assume they don't click just because it's a handheld. I mean, it's
oh, yeah, true. It's a handheld.
And just carrying that around, I would assume it would go out of alignment really quickly if you just had it.
How's the build quality?
The build quality.
Because I never liked the build quality of the none of them, they all felt like it felt a bit flimsy to me. Is it solid or?
There are some pros and cons to the build quality. I think the system itself, it feels really nice. It's like plastic and stainless steel and stuff. Feels really good all around. And then the only parts that feel flimsy are the card slots, so like to insert a memory card or to insert a game. Those, you know, there's still kind of these flimsy things that pop out. Those were
that's to be expected, really.
Yeah, that's true. I would expect that, too. But yeah, that's my only complaint about build quality. Otherwise, it feels really smooth. It feels rugged, so if you drop it, it could break, but I don't know. It's a good build quality, though. And then I got to play at Sony's booth at CES. I got to play 7 different games. So out of all the ones I really liked, Uncharted Golden Abyss definitely stood out. I did this level where I had to use the gyroscope to kind of move the Vita around. I was aiming a sniper rifle and shooting enemies. That felt really good. The game looked amazing on there. I would say comparable to the first Uncharted on PlayStation 3. So you're not getting like Uncharted 3 quality or Uncharted 2 quality, but I'm not saying it looks as good as Uncharted 1, but it's comparable where if you look at the two together, you'd say, oh, they similar, you know, there's no real huge difference. And then the person when I was playing Uncharted, there's usually a person standing by each Vita unit, and that person like went on their lunch break or something. I could have been there all day playing Uncharted, but after 20 minutes I just kind of dropped it. And then another great game I played, Resistance Falling Skies. That was a great one. It's still really early, so like the AI was stupid. They'd stand still and stuff. And the graphics look a little blocky, but I mean, that's to be expected concerning this is an extremely early build of the game. It also took a while to load, but that's still okay. But overall, the dual analog sticks worked really nicely. The controls felt really fluid and really natural. I really liked that one. The third one that stood out for me, Gravity Rush. I absolutely am in love with that game. It looks beautiful on the PlayStation Vita's OLED screen. I don't think I really got to see the OLED screen as good as I want to, considering I was at CES and there were OLED screens that were so much better than the Vita's. But I think if I were to see the Vita just alone without comparing it to the other OLED TVs I saw, I would say the screen looks incredible, really, really good. One of the best portable screens on the market today. But again, back to Gravity Rush. Really fluid controls. At first they told me to use motion controls. They left out the fact that I can use the right stick to aim as well. Like basically in the game, you can like aim yourself and fly to buildings and you're basically in control of gravity. So I found myself more or less using the right stick. That felt most natural to me as it would for any gamer. And then I would use the motion controls to kind of fine tune a little bit, which I think that really worked well and I like that combination. But Gravity Rush is definitely one to look out for when that releases in the springtime. Little Deviants, I didn't really get to play much. Just that that one where you use the back touchpad to control the little ball creature. I think we've all seen that one. That's one of the first tech demos they showed on the Vita. It worked well, but it like the physics of it took a while to get used to because it's like it bounces off. It's like you're creating a hill and the ball bounces off it, so it took a while to figure out, but that was fun. Games I wasn't impressed by. I hate to say I wasn't impressed by Little Big Planet, but there's only one reason. It was because the game was incredibly buggy. Every time I would reach near the end of the level, or I pushed too many buttons all at once, the game would freeze up. It would get all frozen, and I'd have to restart it. The game restarted 3 times during my playthrough of the demo. But overall, I think the game has extreme potential. I think it could end up being one of the, not necessarily a killer app, but the game that utilizes the Vita's functions the best coming out. I think it's coming out this year. Another game that didn't impress me, Unit 13, absolutely terrible. I'm not even going to talk about it. Just avoid it.
But now I want to hear about it.
Okay. So basically, the game is coming out in March. It looks very blocky. The environments are incredibly bland. There's no detail in them. And when I say no detail, there's literally like zero detail. It's just walls, boxes. There's no features to any of it. And then the controls work. I'm not one for those kind of stealth games like SOCOM or something. It's kind of like that. So I kind of just kept dying. And then after 10 minutes of just dying on the first section of the game, just like screw this. And I just dropped it and went away. Another game. I was impressed by one part of it, but overall not really. Mod Nation Racers Road Trip. The game's visuals look extremely bland. Not even as good as the PS3 version. It didn't really look that great. But I was impressed by, I got a demo of the track creator, the track editor, and that was really cool like, you can literally draw the tracks and it'll complete tracks for you. So if you draw an incomplete track which doesn't overlap the beginning of your drawing, it'll automatically do that for you.
That sounds pretty cool.
And then you can create hills and change the altitudes with the rear touchpad. You can place props or have it automatically place props for you. The thing I was most impressed by is that whatever you don't do, the game automatically does for you. So it completes your tracks, it adds props, it adds certain things. You can edit just about every portion of the track. And unfortunately, there's no online multiplayer for this. There's ghosts and there's leaderboards, but...
Wait, isn't that a little redundant?
It is redundant.
Making a game that you can make your own content in and then saying, no, you can't play it with your mates. No, nope, you can't play it with anyone.
Yeah, I think that's the thing a lot of people have an issue with. And I think it would have been bad, but I think it's even worse as how they tried to explain it, as they removed online because they wanted to continue to drive innovation forward with the genre, and yeah. they felt that, you know,
so you make it so you can't race with anybody.
Yeah. Well, I think it has.
No, I don't see how that's driving innovation.
Yeah, you can do local. it has ad hoc, but it doesn't have online, which yeah, I agree is pretty redundant. I'm trying to think.
Especially being that it is, you know, it is, I think this is what, the third game in the Mod Nation franchise.
It is.
Yep.
And it's not. The first two didn't light the world on fire, but. You know, this isn't really going to help it expand.
It's a franchise staple to have online play, and it's a genre staple to have online play, let alone a franchise staple.
Yeah, it's going to be, granted, it hasn't been their answer to Mario Kart yet, but this really will make sure it doesn't become that because...
Well, even Mario Kart has online multiplayer.
Yeah, which is what I'm saying. It's like Mario Kart, you know, even Mario Kart DS had it, but Mario Kart 7 has it, and... It is the market lead in kart racing. I don't think anybody would ever question that.
Yep.
And if you aren't competing with that on its basic features, then, you know, you might as well not really, you know, like, there's no point in it coming out. Especially being that they don't need it for launch, I don't think. So they could have delayed it to make sure that online was in it. Because the Vita, you know, on paper has a ton of titles coming out for launch, and I think, you know, removing Mod Nation Racer doesn't necessarily make the launch weaker.
It doesn't.
But if you had it like an August title with online, that would make it a much more appealing title.
Yeah. So I think that's all I played, but I would definitely say, just in summary, the Vita is awesome. Everything works as it's supposed to. Build quality for the most part is great. The system is incredibly light. The dual analog sticks work well. The games to look out for, Uncharted, definitely. Resistance, when that comes out. Little Big Planet, even though it clearly wasn't ready for the public to get their hands on it. Gravity Rush, absolutely. I think that's the one I'm looking forward to most, maybe even more than Uncharted, just because that demo was amazing. And, yeah. And now I'll get to the Wii U. So... Nintendo did not exhibit at CES. They had no booth. They didn't have a presence. But they were allowing some journalists via appointment to go to a suite in the Hilton, which is literally just a tunnel. Like, they have a skywalk, so a tunnel connecting the two. So I booked an appointment with Nintendo, one of the few people to do so. Got my hands on it. But before I do that, I guess I'll talk about... I had an encounter with Reggie Fils-Aimé, the president of Nintendo America. I wouldn't even say an encounter because we didn't even interact. But so basically, because I always worry about finding places, so I had to make sure I knew where I was going. So I left my hotel an hour early. I got to basically the wing where Nintendo Suite was, right next to the elevator. Well, not next to the elevator, but close to it. I was waiting. I knew exactly where to go now. And all of a sudden, bursting through the hotel doors are Reggie and Scott Mulford, I think, some marketing guy from Nintendo. I think he's marketing at least. So they just walk in. Reggie has like the most serious look on his face. He's ready for action, walking through. And they just walk through. Biggest regret of CES was not running to the elevators to introduce myself, because he was only there to do interviews with like the big sites like CNN or IGN or something like that. But moving on. So I got my hands on four different experiences with the Wii U. The Nintendo employees that went through it were really nice, very energetic. They really tried to like create this environment that they clearly wanted me to have fun rather than worry about. They weren't talking system specs. They weren't talking games. They were very adamant about that. They kept mentioning it. They were very focused on me just having fun with the system, getting my hands on it. So I got to play, the first thing I played was Chase Me. I played it from both perspectives, so I started off on the Wii remote, and I would control a Toad on screen, and someone on the Wii U controller was a me dressed as Mario, and he'd run around, and we'd have to cooperate, the four people on the Wii remotes, to catch the guy who's on the Wii U controller, who has his own interface and can see his own map and all that sort of stuff. There was a lot of yelling and screaming in the room. They clearly, like, I could tell a lot of it felt staged. They were trying to create this fun environment. They were acting very competitive. But I kind of just went with it and had a lot of fun with them. So we were just screaming at each other, he's a blue, he's a blue, no, yellow, yellow. And we caught him with less than 30 seconds left. Then I got to be on the Wii remote. And the Wii U controller itself, really, I'm surprised at how comfortable and light it is in the hands. It feels really good. The controller, the build quality is excellent. It's made of this, like, the back of it, at least, is made of this, like, rugged plastic. You might find it on, like, children's playground equipment or children's toys. That's what it felt like, at least.
It sounds like they've learned from, the existing controllers that are around, like, what's the best, how to design it best to fit a hand as well as have it quite big at the same time.
Well, personally speaking, I've never had an uncomfortable controller from them.
Well, no, but I mean, like, I haven't really been a fan of Nintendo's controllers ever.
But, I mean, that might be the case, but I don't think anybody's ever said their controller. Like, you know, you've had the original Xbox, the Duke, people will say were too big, and I've never really, I mean, there have been complaints about the buttons, especially with the GameCube and stuff like that, and the weird N64 controller, but I've never heard anybody say that the controller itself was uncomfortable.
The Wii U controller was completely comfortable. It felt really good. And I was surprised, like, my biggest complaint I thought would be the dual circle pads. I didn't think those would work well as actual analog sticks, but they do. It's just because I was worried because I thought it would be the same exact circle pads we'd find on the 3DS, but these ones have a lot more give to them where, not necessarily give, but you can stretch them out a lot more, so you have a lot more precision in how you move around. So they work just as good as normal analog sticks. I can definitely confirm that. So I played on the Wii U controller. I had the screen felt not too big, not too small, 6.2 inches. So you can kind of guesstimate how big that would be. So on the Wii U controller, back to Chase Me, I had my own screen. So I had my own gameplay screen of Mario instead of being like a 3D behind the character third person, like it was on the TV screen. This was an overhead view. And then I also had a map which told me where all the other four players were. So I had that advantage of being able to see a map. So I'm playing, the Nintendo guys are screaming. And we're just like, I like hear them, they're like, oh, he's gonna go to the stars. And then I just turn the corner. And they did catch me within the last 30 seconds, just like someone else caught someone. But yeah, that was a really fun one. Second one I played was Battle Me, which was basically a Metroid-esque shooting game where two players would have Wiimotes and nunchucks, and they would control Mii's dressed as Samus, and you'd use the sensor bar to aim, A to shoot, there'd be items to collect, and the person on the Wii U controller was a spaceship. So I'll just talk about the Wii U experience. The spaceship you control using the gyroscope, so you'd tilt the Wii remote, you tilt the Wii U controller around, and that felt really good. Like, these Nintendo guys, they were honestly treating me like I've never played a video game before. They're like, this button does this. If you tilt it, it does that. And it's like,
say, though, that seems to be the staple with any of these, because even like when we went to Comic-Con, people were doing the same thing.
Yeah, but
like, have you ever played this game before? Like, if you hold down start, you can begin the game. Like, thank you.
Yeah, but I mean, this was CES, so a lot of these people are tech journalists. They're not necessarily gamers. So that also, I thought, played a part in it. But
I mean, it goes to the art of philosophy. This is why, even though people get pissed off, a lot of games still have tutorials, because you always want to treat the game like it's the first time anybody's saying it.
Yeah.
And if it's like your fifth one, you kind of get annoyed. But if it is somebody's first one, they are thankful for that.
Absolutely. So it was funny because they're like, oh, it does this, you know, you control it like that. And then I'm like, I think I got it. And then within minutes, I was controlling it just as good as them. I won. I beat both. Basically, I had six hearts. They had three each, the two Samuses. And I had to shoot them. I had to avoid their shots. And it was a very close match. It was like 1-1, and I got the winning blow. But yeah, that one was a lot of fun as well. The gyro controls worked really well. Now moving on to the third experience, this was something they don't show at trade shows and conventions, only at private appointments. And the reason they do that is because the picture, the image on screen, the video they're playing of this Tokyo Street is in standard definition rather than high definition, but they said obviously it would be able to do it in high definition as well. So on the screen was a static image of a Tokyo Street, and then you have the same thing on the Wii U controller, but it's like a live panorama where you move it to the sides, you can see more of the street, you can see what's behind you. If you hold the Wii U controller up to the sky, you see the clouds. If you hold it down to the ground, you see the street. That one worked incredibly well as well. No complaints there. But you can see the potential of, like, creating a game world. You can literally look all around. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like something like Skyrim.
Yep.
Where you can just view all of this. Yeah.
You can just view every little bit of it, and just it's almost like a magic mirror, a viewfinder into another world. It was really cool.
Yeah, I think, and I've seen videos of it, and it looks cool. But I mean, the part of me is just like, I don't get any gameplay applications for that technology.
Well, not yet, at least.
Not yet.
But yeah, but then you're taking your eye off, and you're gonna end up taking your eye off the screen. But you're also, it's gonna be weird, like, oh, if you're playing a shooter, and like, there's enemies behind you, so you have to move the controller behind you to spot them or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be figured out as it goes. I think there's gonna be a lot of trial and error with developers.
There always is, or people are just gonna not use it. But yeah, I mean, I'm curious about this, because it does seem like right now the big push for the Wii U is going to be asymmetrical multiplayer. And what are your thoughts on that?
What are my thoughts on asymmetrical? I mean, they wouldn't confirm anything about two Wii U controllers for a system, but I mean, I liked it. It worked really well between some people using the Wii remotes and one person using the Wii U controller. It was fun. It provided both a competitive and cooperative aspect as well. So I thought that was really cool. So everyone would be versing the person at the with the Wii U controller, but everyone was cooperating to do so. So there's two different experiences, basically.
Yeah, I mean, that's what asymmetrical is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, true. I can't see it working for every game, but I think whoever can provide it will do so.
It doesn't work for every game, but it can, you know, it does add a new wrinkle to multiplayer. I mean, I think, and I obviously this wasn't at the show, but at E3 they had the Clear Freaks from Outer Space demo, and that had asymmetrical first person thing where it's kind of like Left 4 Dead, where one player was the AI director who was like spawning enemies and stuff like that. And you know, that opens up the door for different multiplayer experiences. Yeah. But I'm curious.
It's fun nonetheless, but I don't know how they can do symmetrical or if symmetrical is just limited to Wii remotes and nunchucks.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering about. Is like, you know, is symmetrical just going to be an evolution of what we see in this generation? Especially if, you know, like, I mean, I'm not saying that they technically need support for four Wii U controllers. It'd be nice. But, you know, like, two, even, like, you know, you can see stuff like Madden and stuff where, you know, Faycon isn't on the screen anymore. It's on the controller, so nobody, you know, your opponent doesn't know what you're picking or what's your possible plays and stuff like that. Or even football, where you can design out stuff. I should say soccer, not to confuse people.
Yeah.
So I'm curious. But, I mean, all in all, you had fun with your time with this device.
Yep. I also saw the Zelda demo, which, I mean, all I can say, the image looked the video, or it was actually running in real time, so I was controlling the camera, but Zelda looks amazing in HD. That's all I can say. It's pretty awesome. I'm still curious as to how much power it was using of the Wii U and all that, but we'll only have to figure that out in time.
Okay. So yeah, thanks for that. And you know, I guess this will parlay into the big news of the week, is that Nintendo actually kind of said some stuff about the Wii U. They've said a lot of stuff this week. But I mean, I guess the beginning, we'd have to talk about their financial statement. And Nintendo, you know, they've had to downshift their projections for the Wii, the 3DS. You know, I think they've downgraded the expected Wii console sales from 12 million to 10 million, and 3DS from 16 to 14 million. It happens, they didn't have a strong enough Christmas, but I think what's more damning, I guess, is the software downgrade, where I think they've downgraded the software by like 18 million units, which is a huge gap to fill.
It is.
I assume that behind closed doors, there were software titles they expected to come out in Q1 that aren't making it. Like Kid Icarus was, I assume, in a Q1 title, but that's actually in the Q2 now. I think it's in April release.
Oh no, it's still in March.
Oh, it's still in March.
It's a late March, of quarter one.
And I guess they have low expectations, but because there's a lot of quality titles for the 3DS that's ported. There's Resident Evil Revelations, there's Kid Icarus. Japan has like the Elf's Hotel thingy. There's Kingdom Hearts 3D out next week, I think, or sometime soon.
Yeah,
no, that's out in March as well.
It's March.
Yeah. So they have titles. I guess they just don't expect them to sell as well as they hoped.
I think it is hard because it's like when Awada was doing the whole Nintendo Direct thing in Japan, that broadcast, he made it clear there are now games for the 3DS. These games especially appeal to the Japanese market with Kingdom Hearts and Monster Hunter now and all the stuff that's going to be coming, Bravery Default. There's countless names, but I think, and this might even lead into other things Nintendo said, I don't think they're expecting their actual software to sell as well. So if you look, none of their titles coming out between 2012 and early 2013, which is their next fiscal year, aren't going to be million sellers. So Kid Icarus, it might do really well, but I think it's hard to bet that it'll sell a million copies. Actually, yeah. I mean, it could. I think there's a good chance, but there's no
guarantee. I think worldwide it's going to sell a million copies.
Yeah, worldwide it'll be a million, but in the U.S., in one single country, not the case.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's one of those expectations where, you said this will probably into other things where Nintendo announced, but I mean, look at their other franchises. Mario 3D and sold, 5 million in a month and a half. Yep. Mario Kart 7 sold 4.5 million in like 3 weeks. Skyward Sword sold 3.5 million in 5 weeks. I don't see Kid Icarus doing that. And
I can't either. And the thing is, Nintendo, I think, put a lot of bets on Kid Icarus because this is a massive game that's been in development for a long time, at least 2.5 to 3 years. There's a lot that they've been trying to do with it. They've really been pushing Sakurai and his team. Sakurai's been pushing his team, rather. And it'll be interesting to see, because I think they've invested so much money in this game already. Hopefully they make a turnaround and get a profit.
Yeah, I think part of it is also that them just trying to broaden their franchise base. Even though Kid Icarus is an old franchise, it hasn't been right for like 20 years. And this will also go into stuff, is that I love Mario games, I really do, but I do think they're kind of falling into that old trap again where they rely too much on him, because we just had Mario Kart 7, we had Super Mario 3D, and they announced that there's a new 2D Mario that's set to come out in the next fiscal year, which is anytime between April 2012 and March 2013. And I'm just thinking, like, this would make, I think there's been a Mario title every year since 2009. There's been New Super Mario Bros., there's Super Mario Galaxy 2, Super Mario 3D, and now this one. And I also assume that New Super Mario Bros. Me is going to be out sometime this year or next.
It could be, yeah. I mean, that was just a tech demo. There's no guarantee of a release, but I think they're going to try to release a Mario game for Wii U, just because Mario is what sells. Every gamer loves Mario. Everyone who owns a 3DS but most people are just like, I've got to have the latest Mario title. They're all really good, high-quality games.
Yeah.
They get their money.
New Super Mario Bros. Wii and New Super Mario Bros. DS have both sold 25 million units apiece. Mm-hmm. I'm fairly certain there's going to be a sequel. I don't believe in this just a tech demo business.
Not only that, you'll be able to find out what they're actually going to do with the screen on the Wii U's controller with it. Maybe they'll do something interesting, maybe they won't.
That's the thing. It's like right now, it doesn't seem like it has any interesting uses for that type of game. But they found some way to get motion into New Super Mario Bros. Wii, and while not everybody's a fan of it, I thought it improved the game minorly. I am curious to see what they do with it. I just don't want them to say And Iwata even kind of hinted at this, that, you know, like Mario is what sells systems. But, you know, you can't have like 50 Mario games in a year because then it just kind of dilutes the brand.
It does, yeah. That's exactly what happened to Guitar Hero.
Yeah, and it's one of the reasons Mario has existed for 27 years is that even though there's a lot of games with Mario, the core games have always kind of been spaced out. I mean, you had the 3 on the Nintendo, then one on Super Nintendo, one on N64, one on GameCube, and then 3 on the Wii. So, we shall see. In addition to that, they've announced the Nintendo Network, which is, I mean, first it's the renaming of the Nintendo Wi-Fi Connection, which is always such a, I always thought it was such a lazy name.
It was, yeah.
It's like saying, oh, it connects to the internet. Thank you, Nintendo. but yes, it's, you know, it's a renaming of that. It's broadening of their services. They announced that the Wii U will have an account system and you can have multiple accounts per console.
It's just a Nintendo catching up, really, what they should have done with the Wii.
Well, it could have been with the, I mean, one, I don't think the Wii was built for account systems. I don't think even if they had a firmware, it would have done that just because of how they programmed the system.
Mm-hmm.
And the other hand, on the other side, I always said I won't defend their online stance, but they did sell 95 million units of the Wii without proper online. So I could see why it wasn't a huge priority for them.
Yeah. I mean, now kind of is, if they want that core gaming market.
That core gaming market, but I also think they're more concerned with the social aspect of gaming. I think, you know, that's kind of what the Wii brought to the table, is that social, you know, everybody in the room having fun together. They kind of continued that with the 3DS, the Street Pass, where you kind of have that social interaction, where they make it an event for you to carry out your 3DS with you. Because one, it helps you get stuff in the system, but you also meet and interact with other gamers on the streets if they have their 3DS, and you get to use that in various ways. And I think going forward, they want to continue that social push into the online sector. And I assume that I don't imagine that this will compete with Xbox Live in features, but I can see them doing a lot of stuff that's very Nintendo-like with online.
Mm-hmm.
Even some of the stuff they've hinted at with this Nintendo Network and this investors meeting seems like it's a very Nintendo-esque way of doing stuff.
Nintendo Network also doesn't restrict it to just the internet either. It could be ad hoc as well.
Yeah, and there's stuff like, I mean, one of the things, and this is basically what PC games do, but not a lot of Xbox and PS3 games do. One of the things they mention with the Nintendo Network is communities, which, if you've played Mario Kart 7, you know, it's kind of like your own special server of certain rules. Like, with Mario Kart, you can have like 150cc bananas only races and stuff like that, or you can have bombs only battle mode. And the only way you can get in is if you know the code or your friend sets it up with you. And that's one of those things where I think a lot of people would kind of want that, where it's like, oh, I can play online games with just my friends without having to find a bunch of randoms. Or if you're part of like Twitter or a forum or, you know, anything, you can have like, oh, this is like our Twitter group, and you have people from there who you don't necessarily need to be friends with, but you can always pull from that group because they're like-minded gamers, mm-hmm. and play with them. And I think that, you know, one, I hope that's something that, you know, Sony and Microsoft kind of follow through with going forward as well, because a lot of people hate random people online, especially those 12-year-old brats who want trash talk.
Yeah.
And more importantly, the people who have more fun with the game when they break it, so it's not fun for anybody else, like falling through maps, using glitches and stuff like that. And you just, you know, if you can find a way to avoid people, or like if there's a system that you can ban people like that, so that it's a bit more fair and level, I can see that, you know, being something I would enjoy personally.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I will also say, though, that personally speaking, I like Nintendo well enough, I'm a huge fan, but I also don't always take what they say at face value. it sounds good on paper, but
we know Nintendo, they've always got their quirks on how things are implemented, like demos on 3DS, etc.
Yeah.
We went through this after. Sorry, I don't mind how the demos are implemented on the 3DS. I do think it's odd, but it's not a deal breaker.
Well, no, I'm not saying that it's always a bad thing the way Nintendo implements things, but they have their own little quirks that...
Yeah, they definitely do.
They can't do anything straight. They can't just say, you know, like, people want demos, we're just going to put them up. It's like, people want demos, but, you know, we got to make sure these people buy games, so we'll give them 30 tries at this demo, and once that's done, they better buy the game or else. And, it's always those quirks, but those quirks are also some ways that makes them a special company.
Mm-hmm.
I've mentioned this before. I think I mentioned this on the site. I don't know if I mentioned it on the podcast. But like Swapnote, for example, is their answer to like a messaging service on Xbox Live and PSN.
Swapnote is great. I love it.
I love Swapnote. Swapnote is a terrible messaging service, though. There's no way I would ever use that to set up a game with my friends because it's not instantaneous. You have to download notes and stuff like that. So for direct communications, it's awful. But as a product, as like a game app or a service, it's really a ton of fun.
Yep. I don't think this is meant to be like an instant messaging service or anything. It's just fun to like send people drawings or send people pictures. I think it's a good solution for that.
I think they wanted it to be a messaging service. But, you know, it's just Nintendo being Nintendo where you can't get messages right away. Even though your 3DS will get them, you still have to download them, and then it just becomes this pain in the ass.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the service is tremendous. I mean, I love, you know, the drawings and, like everybody has their photos and the different postcards. And I really hope that it's integrated into the Wii U's OS.
You could easily have it where you draw stuff on the tablet.
Yeah.
Easy.
What else did they announce at this? They have 200 games for the 3DS. I've always found this stupid when people give out these numbers because like you can have 200 games, but if only 5 of them are worth anything.
Well, yeah, that's what instead of telling us how many there is, they should pick maybe 10 big names and just say we've got this, that, the other coming, like Sony did with the Vita. You know,
well, Sony also has
we've got Killzone, Uncharted, Call of Duty. You know.
Well, Sony also has we have over 100 games in development for the Vita. Nintendo has highlighted certain games. It's just that the thing was they just did the Nintendo Direct, which highlighted their Q1 launch, Q1 titles, and they even have some of them highlighted on the website. You know, like the Luigi's Mansion, your Mario Tennis, your Resident Evil, your Kingdom Hearts, and stuff like that. So they do it. But I've always just found it weird. It's like a dick waving contest, to be honest. Whenever a company says that, oh, there's so many games in development for us. It's like, yeah, but half of those are probably not games anybody's ever going to see or care about. It just sounds good. It's better than saying, oh, we only have 20 games in development right now.
Yeah. It's quantity versus quality.
Yeah, and people always kind of, you know, and part of it is also, though, it's hard sometimes to peg what is quality.
Yeah,
like there are, you know,
true.
It's easy to say, oh, yeah, the next Mario game, the next Zelda game, because those are storied franchises. But like 3 or 4 years ago, I don't think anybody would have ever considered Monster Hunter a huge game.
Mm-hmm.
And you've seen what happened with that, at least in Japan, where it's become this huge franchise. So,
And speaking of games, they also announced a new Mario title for their next fiscal year. So anytime between 2012 and early 2013, it could be out.
Yeah, and I mean we'll see.
Yeah.
I mentioned before that I'm not a fan of the fact that this basically a franchise at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But the major difference between this and I would say like a Call of Duty or an Assassin's Creed is that you can play New Super Mario Bros. Wii, you can play Super Mario Galaxy 2, and you can play Super Mario 3D back to back.
And they're all three different games.
They're three distinct games. They're all using the same core character, but they've all have, you know, one's tricky 2D, one's 3D.
One's kind of
one's
a combination.
Galaxy's a lot more variety. You know, New Super Mario Bros. Wii is more strict. You know, point A to point B. Super Mario 3D is kind of a combination of the two.
Yes.
And that's kind of why I think, you know, people haven't really turned against it so much, is that the games are radically different.
Yep,
but I still don't like the fact that they're coming out so rapidly, and I do hope after this they take a break. Or at least go with the Mario spinoffs, you know, like the Paper Marios, the Mario and Luigi games.
I mean,
like
they do have two of those in the works for the fiscal year as well. They have Luigi's Mansion 2.
Well, they have several, because they have Luigi's Mansion, they have Mario Tennis, and they have Paper Mario 3DS.
Yep, so they're definitely rolling all those out as quickly as they can.
Yeah, but this is kind of like the GameCube mentality, where it's like, we're not doing so hot, so we'll just put Mario and everything. And they kind of got away with it with the Wii, because they didn't need Mario as much, because the Miis were the kind of go-to thing. And, you know, I think, you know, it's just as important to kind of nurture those kind of growths and IPs, which is kind of what they're trying to do with Kid Icarus, making it into a bigger deal. They've been trying it with Metroid for a decade now. As much as I love the games that come out, I don't think Metroid... I don't know why Metroid doesn't resonate with gamers as much as it should, but it doesn't. And I think that's it for the Nintendo's investors meeting. I don't know. There was a lot of news. A lot of it, as people mentioned, was kind of... It wasn't to cover up their financial troubles. I think it was kind of to reassure investors that they have something in the pipelines to help them curb this hemorrhaging money they've been doing this past year.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, we'll see. I mean, they've projected that they'll lose money this entire financial year, which would be the first time they've done it in, I think, 30-some-odd years. But part of it was that, you know, Nintendo has never really been that great at transitioning their consoles. So while, you know, the 3DS is coming in, that didn't have a hot start. The Wii's going out, or the Wii's been out. So it's kind of like they just kind of have those two times overlapping each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's that. Insomniac Games announced that they're done with the Resistance franchise.
You know, I kind of like it when the companies do this, you know, that we've had enough, we're going to move on to something new, you know, and something new is always nice. Naughty Dog have a reputation for doing that, and, well, they've already done it this year, haven't they? Or last year. So, it's always nice. I mean, they said that the Resistance franchise will continue anyway, so for anyone who's liked it. So, you know, it's a win-win as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I mean, I got my hands on the first Resistance game that wasn't made by Insomniac. It's made by, forget the name, something with an N. Nihilithic or so, it's something like that, but I would say it's in good hands. I didn't have any problems with Burning Skies. I mean, I only did play one level, but I think there are a lot of capable studios that Sony owns that can easily handle Resistance.
But, I mean, that's the other thing, though, is, like, do you want another studio just handing in your IP? Like, I mean, you know, like, if the story's been told, they can just, you know, they can just kind of move on, and because they have enough shooter franchises. They still have Killzone, they have SOCOM, they have MAG, they have that new one, I think, what is it, Dust something?
Dust 514?
Dust 514 is...
Yeah.
Strictly
so.
It's PS3 exclusive only because they want to get it on consoles. Just it ain't gonna happen with Microsoft.
So, but yeah, I mean, there you go. They have shooter franchises, so they don't necessarily. And it's not like Resistance has personally been eating up the sales chart, so it's not like it's gonna be a huge loss to them. And they could have, you know, Insomniac isn't a Sony developer anymore, so, and we know that because Overstrike is a multi-platform game, which is the next title. But they can have, you know, like one of their studios, instead of focusing on trying to keep this brand alive, go back to the well and see what they can come up with that's new and original for them, and maybe see if they can make that into a more worthwhile franchise instead of trying to replicate the success of Resistance.
Yep.
It was also kind of funny because I guess Sony fans weren't exactly happy with this. So Ted Price, who's the president of Insomniac Game, had to come out, and he released a video explaining why they were done with Resistance and how they, you know, they are looking forward to seeing where the franchise goes in the future, but they are no longer involved in the development of it.
I tell you what, I'm not really a fan of the games that Insomniac produced, but I really like Ted Price. He seems like a real down-to-earth guy.
There's a lot of developers, I think, that are, and then there's some
I don't think he gets enough credit, because I don't like David Jaffe. As far as I'm concerned, he likes the sound of his own voice. I'm not a fan of Cliffy B either.
They kind of get the recognition because they're like the two most
because they're outlandish and badass and
yeah. I mean, the only other people who kind of get that respect are even until you get people like Peter Molyneux. Who's outspoken, but more hyperbolic than anything else. You know, but then you get people like, you know, Will Wright, Shiggy,
Gabe Newell.
Kojima, Gabe Newell. But even then, those people are still kind of vocal. They're just not asses. And yeah, you get people kind of stay in the shadows, but they do great work. It's just that the people don't recognize it as much. Speaking of stuff that people don't recognize, I'm pretty sure at this point Capcom is just messing with their fans, but they announced that Mega Man and Pac-Man will be exclusive characters on PlayStation 3 and Vita.
Why?
Not 100% sure why. Yeah.
Why?
At first I was like, why? It doesn't. At first I was like, until I saw what it actually looked like, and then I'm like, okay, this can actually work.
Well, it's not so much that the characters make sense. I mean, if you think Capcom, actually, I wouldn't say Mega Man's Capcom's icon. I think Capcom has a lot of characters. I don't think one's really that this is Capcom image. I mean, I think Ryu can fit it just as well as Mega Man can, but it makes sense. And Pac-Man, I think you associate with Namco because he is Gaiman's oldest icon.
I mean, in terms of the characters, it makes sense, but how would I just kept wondering, how would Pac-Man fit in a fighting game? They give him this something. So I'm like,
oh my god, Pac-Man looks, actually, I changed my mind. Pac-Man looks awesome. Fucking giant robot. Okay, I need to play this game just to play as Pac-Man.
Yeah, and Mega Man is, and this is what I meant by trolling fans, is Mega Man is the version of Mega Man.
Mega Man.
Yeah. Yes, he's the one from the box art on the original Mega Man Nintendo Entertainment System. And a lot of people are not happy with it because it's Fat Mega Man. And we've seen Mega Man in fighting games because he's in the Marvel vs. Capcom franchise.
Yep.
So they can do him, and if they wanted, I mean, I think Mega Man X has always kind of been portrayed as a taller Mega Man, so he would fit more in the universe. But no, they went with Fat Mega Man. I mean, personally speaking, I'm more curious as to why these are PlayStation and Vita exclusive.
Yeah, they're not. I could understand if they were PlayStation franchises, but they're not, because obviously it's Pac-Man and Mega Man. So, I don't know.
Even so, I would say that if we were talking purely this generation, I would say that Pac-Man is more associated with the Xbox brand because of the championship edition.
Yeah, definitely.
So, I mean, I don't know why. I mean, I've read that they wanted to do Microsoft exclusive characters as well. And they approached Microsoft and they couldn't get the timing worked out. They wanted to get either Master Chief or Marcus Fenix.
Oh, Microsoft wouldn't allow that.
But they did a Spartan in Dead or Alive already, so it's not.
I mean, that was because they got Dead or Alive 4 out for the launch window. They appreciated that.
Yeah.
More or less that, I think it is.
But I think, you know, you work with these people and you kind of build up that relationship. And, you know, at the end of the day, this is going to help Sony more than anything because there's really no reason to go with the Xbox version.
Well, exactly, because you've got more stuff in the PS3 version, Mortal Kombat.
Yeah, if I was Microsoft, I would try anything. I mean, granted, I personally just wanted to see Marcus Fenix just to see how he would translate into a fighting game.
Mm-hmm. Especially with the Street Fighter kind of visual style as well, that would be interesting.
I was going to say that he would fit in right with Street Fighter 4 anyhow.
So. Marcus Fenix, though, I think would be better with, like, Mortal Kombat. He's got the fatality with the chainsaw.
Yeah. That's why I want to see him in this, because he doesn't technically fit. They're not really fighters in Gears of War.
Let's put it this way. If Capcom can put Fenix right in a fighting game, they can put anybody in a fighting game.
If I was Microsoft and Epic, I would be more, you know, like Fenix, right, is Capcom's thing, so they can do what they want. But if you're,
the mechanics.
Oh no, I get what you're saying, but what I'm saying is that like with Marcus Fenix, Epic and Microsoft probably want to have an image of him to portray, where like, you know, you don't have your tough guy in some goofy fighting game. I'm not saying that's true, but I can see that being like, you know what, it doesn't really fit his image, and we have big plans for this franchise, because, I mean, Halo and Gears are their two biggest franchises. It would kind of make sense to procure their image and make sure they are still seen as the hardcore dude pro games and not seen in that, I don't want to sound derogatory, but, you know, in that anime-esque world and goofy, colorful characters. And it's probably a prejudice that some gamers have, which is stupid, but, you know, it is what it is. I'm also kind of curious if there's going to be like a Nintendo version of this, because it seems like it would be a perfect. I mean, I would love to see Mega Man and Pac-Man and the next Smash Brothers. So it would be a fair trade-off if they got Egg Inc. and Metro and Samus in this, but we shall see.
Yeah.
Next is one that I wish Jason was here for, because he's never here for this. He wasn't here for Batman Arkham City either.
Yes, there isn't an argument in the world that can defend this, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, then you haven't seen Twitter, because there's been a lot of arguments.
There is
the
not. I don't care. There is not an argument in the world that can defend this.
There's been a lot of arguments defending this, and it's really... First we have to explain what it is. It's that the Kingdoms of Amalur has, I think, about 5 hours of single-player content knocked out behind an online pass.
That's ridiculous.
That is.
So, yes, like much like Batman Arkham City, single-player content is actually knocked out in an online pass. How ridiculous that sounds is up to you.
I mean, one reason it's ridiculous is also because there are probably a lot of gamers who don't necessarily have their consoles connected to the internet. That content is permanently blocked out if they don't connect.
Yeah, and that is one of the first arguments people bring up. And it's not, they should just buy new. It's that argument. It's that not everybody has internet connection, or not everybody has.
And even some people that do have an internet connection can't, for whatever reason, connect their consoles to it, or they can't download things off the internet. So
yeah, or there's people at Canada, some of the providers have caps, so like you're wasting part of your internet to get
or your region isn't an Xbox Live supported region, because there's a lot of people that have problems with that.
That's the first argument people bring up, and their thing, people's defense of this, and I swear to you I've heard this before, is that then they don't deserve the full game.
You cannot say they don't deserve it, because they paid the money. They bought it new, they haven't done anything wrong, and they're being locked out for some arbitrary reason. It's ridiculous.
But then they should work on their internet connection. It's their fault. It's not the publisher's fault. They've given them the access to the thing. If they can get on the internet, it's their fault. I've seen this argument, I swear you, not more than once this past week.
How self-entitled can you be to say, I have a higher moral status than you because I can fork out $40 for an internet connection every month? Yeah.
Here's the funny thing, though, is that I've always said that gamers have a sense of entitlement, but to me, this is the opposite of entitlement. Gamers are willingly bending over backwards for developers to say that, you know what, I feel bad for these people. I am give them my money because they deserve it.
My reason why I can't support this is I'm paying money and I'm not getting shit, I'm not directly getting what's on the disc.
Yeah, I've seen this argument this morning, is that... it's extra content. You're paying for bonus features.
But I'm not, because it's already on the disc. I pay for the disc.
But they're giving it to you as an extra, as an incentive to buy new. Aren't you happy with that?
And I can't believe this. I have to ask permission, right, to gain access to this content that I've paid for. Right, and I have no guarantees that the code I'm given will work. No guarantees that if it doesn't work, I'll get one that does. You know, this happened with Arkham City. Half of people's codes didn't work.
Yeah, and that's another issue. It's not just Arkham City. It's happened with there was a Need for Speed where some of these codes expire. They don't let you know that.
And
some of them don't work when you get them.
Ubisoft has had this problem. Driver San Francisco. They completely removed the online pass requirement entirely because of it.
Not that it's happened often, but we saw it with the PSN outage, where you couldn't access the Mortal Kombat and the Portal 2 stuff because it was out for 6 weeks.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of stuff that, there's a lot of barriers of entry. It's not just, you just have to input 10-digit code, and you're good to go. You have to make sure you have a high-speed internet. You gotta make sure your internet's not capped off. You gotta make sure that your code works. It's a lot of steps to get everything that you paid for. And it's punishing people who buy new just as much as it's punishing people who buy used. And this is what I don't get. This is why I don't get why gamers are so willing to accept this, because they feel bad because GameStop apparently makes $2 billion and they feel bad because that's $2 billion that the game industry isn't getting. Even though in December alone, the game industry made, $10 billion in the States alone.
And here's another problem I have, right? Is I can understand the argument of, I play my games on a console because it's easier, right? But now what we're doing is we're basically turning consoles into what PCs used to be, say, 10 years ago, where you have to put your game in, you have to put a code in to prove that you bought it new, you have to wait for something to download, you know, then you may have to turn your console on and wait for a firmware update, you know?
Yeah,
convenience to it anymore. If I can go on Steam and just click buy on Skyrim and I can be playing it once I've downloaded it, or if I can, in fact, when I buy Skyrim in a store, I put the code into Steam, that's it, I'm playing. I don't need to do anything else, you know?
Yeah, you're
removing the convenience from console gaming, and it's the reason why people buy consoles to play video games in the first place.
It's not just you're removing the convenience, it's also, and granted, not everybody sees it this way, maybe everybody assumes that if you're not buying used, you're going to buy it new, which I don't necessarily think. I think if you're not buying it used, you're just not going to wait, you're just not going to buy it, or you're going to wait until a price collapse, which I think is worse for the market, because nobody buys anything day one anymore if I can wait 2 weeks and get it for $20.
Exactly, yeah, game prices are just dropping incredibly fast. I haven't bought as many games. I have some, like, oh, 6 months later, they're going to be half the price.
I only bought Skyrim 3 days ago because I was waiting for a price drop.
If it was six months later, that would be something. But, I mean, I got Rayman Origins this month for $20. I got Saints Row the Third 3 weeks after it came out for $30. You get a bunch of these games. If you just wait it out 2 or 3 weeks, you can get them for half off. And that's not good either for the industry, because then there's no value in $60 games, and nobody's going to buy it up front. And a lot of people depend on those first day sales. And it's going to start looking bad when games do 100,000 first week.
Yeah, it's an interesting business model. Just like, I think $60 is for the early adopters or the hardcore fans of the series who are just going to go out and buy it anyway. And then you wait a few weeks to trickle the price down, you're going to get a lot more buyers.
And here's another problem, right? So, you know, if you wait for a game to drop in price, there's going to be DLC by the time you've waited and bought it. So, you know, you're not encouraging anyone to buy new at all. If you were to lower the price of entry when the game's new, then maybe you wouldn't have this problem. But
That was going to be my other point, is that if you see that people are willing to either buy a game used, and sometimes the used prices aren't that much different. GameStop is anywhere from $5 to $20. And then people are willing to wait until it drops into $40, $30 to pick it up. And so if you see that there's a price of entry that people are willing to buy your game at, maybe that's what you should be targeting it and not saying $60 and people are going to buy it.
I mean, I remember when THQ had this whole idea about how they were going to drop prices for games and then they were going to sell more DLC when the game's actually released. We had the more DLC come because obviously Saints Row the Third's got shitloads of it, but we didn't see the initial drop in price of the game.
But, I mean, I digress, because this honestly can go on for days, and like I said, I wish Jason was here, because as far as I know, he's the only one of us who actually defends
this. And the funny thing is who's behind this harebrained scheme in the first place? Oh, by EA, that just happens to be publishing Kingdoms of Amalur Reckoning. What a coincidence.
EA is probably, I mean, I think EA was the first one with the Mass Effect 2 stuff, and EA is probably the most guilty party, but I was going to say that if this rumor is also to be believed, Microsoft seems to be taking this to a whole new level, where they're making exclusive content
game-proof consoles.
Yeah, they're tying in new game purchases somehow to the console, to the account, somehow. And I honestly, if they do this, this is market suicide, I think.
Well, I'll just forgo the next generation of consoles entirely, because it's going to catch on. And Sony's going to go, oh, hang on, this is a good idea. Nintendo's going, oh, this is a good idea, let's do that as well. You know, in which case I'm just going to stay on Steam where I'm, you know.
I
can only buy games new anyway, and I can get them cheap during sales, because I can't do that.
This is probably only me, you know, defending Nintendo. But I don't see how it's beneficial to Nintendo. Because right now, they are the only company in gaming, and I think they probably are the only company who can still sell a 5-year-old game at full price. So I don't think they have a problem with the secondhand market as much as other people.
Because they don't have a problem with the secondhand market as much doesn't mean they're not going to try and get rid of it.
I see the only reason I would see them not doing this, and this is probably one of the few times where their conservative nature kind of comes in favor, is that they really don't like having that huge gap between the player and starting the game. And since part of their market is kids, I think that's a huge step for them, and they probably don't want to have that happen to them. Because it's one of the reasons why, you know, Nintendo's a really super conservative company. It's one of the reasons they didn't store any of your information on the Wii is because they didn't want your information to be stolen or, you know, it's frustrating to the consumer, but at the same hand, I don't see them doing this for the same reason, because to them, it's just like, it's too many steps for you to start your game, and they want you to get into that game as soon as possible. I could be wrong, though. Like I said,
things can change.
Things can change, but to me, they seem to be the only company that knows, how to value it. Because, I mean, look at this, they sold, what is it, I think it's 1.10 million copies of Super Mario Galaxy this past quarter, which is a 4-year-old game. I don't really think secondhand market hurts them as much as everybody else does. And I also don't think secondhand market hurts everybody as much as they want to.
Oh, no, of course it doesn't.
Yeah.
I think people see, oh, GameStop makes such and such as much money. That should be money going back into the industry. But they don't see it there's a lot of counterpoints to that. Is that, one, GameStop is one of the few video game only stores in the country, in the world. Two, is that those used game sales are usually people selling games to buy new games, because GameStop always has, oh, trade in 3 games and get like 60% off Modern Warfare 3 pre-order or Mass Effect 3 pre-order. So it's people trading in their games to buy
new
games.
That, I could understand the massive concern for it if one used game sale breeds 2 games, but it doesn't. You buy one game, you sell it to GameStop, somebody buys that one game. There can only be one game from one new sale. It's not like piracy in which in 10 minutes you can have hundreds of thousands of copies of the same thing. It's still one thing that's been paid for.
And the other thing is that in this day and age, it's no longer a dead revenue source. Just because somebody buys a game used doesn't mean you can't get money off of them. And I don't mean like out part of the content, like online passes. I mean DLC.
Yeah.
Personally speaking, if I have Saints Row the Third right here, I'm not buying any DLC for it. That means that you're not getting any more money from me. If I sold it back to the store, somebody bought it, and there's somebody who wants to buy $10.59 DLC, you're making more money off of them continuously than you would if I bought it.
I bought Fallout 3 used. It's one of the only games that I've ever bought used, and I bought all the DLC for that game because I loved it.
And that's like $60 they got back from you that they probably wouldn't have gotten from the person who sold it, because it's just going to sit on their shelf doing nothing. So, I mean, we shall see. I do think the gaming industry needs to kind of shore up some of its problems. I don't think fighting used games is that problem. I think, and we've had this discussion before, I think it's that boom or bust mentality that they have. And, I mean, get into our final point. It's also this focus on a singular market. THQ is ditching their kids and license route and focusing solely on core gamers.
If that's what they make money in, then why not?
I actually think this is the wrong thing to
really?
Do. I think getting into the core game is the harder thing. I mean, it's the core division that's usually draining them of the money. Not saying that licensed products are helping them. I mean, part of the reason they're in this mess is because of the how poorly you draw did on the 360 and the PS3. But I honestly think that's just not knowing your audience. I don't know why they thought that would sell to that audience. But, I mean, the fact is THQ's had games like The Blob, they've had Red Faction, they've had all these kind of quote-unquote core games come out this year that went under expectations. So it's not like that's not hurting them. It's that these games are the ones that you put a lot of money behind, and if they don't sell 3 or 4
million copies. The issue I had with this is a lot of the franchises they mentioned were, like, they mentioned, like, the franchises they wanted to concentrate on. Company of Heroes, that's a PC-exclusive thing. Dawn of War, Warhammer, that's been a PC-exclusive thing until Space Marine came along, you know? So they need to work more on getting the core console games out as well, instead of just releasing PC games a lot of the time.
I can see that happening. And, I mean, it's not... I think a good company, a smart company, would have a well-balanced portfolio where it's not just, like, you know, you know, this is kind of like Activision and Take-Two, where it's kind of like, oh, we have Grand Theft Auto, and then we kind of have nothing else for the year, which is why every year you see them up, oh, somebody's interested in buying Take-Two. Then you have Red Dead Redemption come out, oh, you know, they're fine now. And then it repeats Red Dead, you know, it repeats L.A. Noire, they're up on the top, oh, it does well, you know. That's not it. That's not a mentality you can maintain. That's not a business model that's sustainable. Because if one of their games come out and is a buzz,
Take-Two just happens to be in the in the lucky position of not having games that flop
yet. And I think Activision's in the same position because as of right now, if the next Call of Duty came out and flopped, they would be in very, very deep, because they have no other franchise
Five studios, there's a lot of money to go down the drain.
Yeah, there's a lot of money invested in the franchise, but, and that's exactly the problem, is like, if it does come out and doesn't do as hot as the last one, is that there's really nothing to kind of support it. It's kind of why I've always said that Ubisoft is such a frustrating company, but they're also smart. As much, you know, they have their Assassin's Creed, they have their Rayman and stuff like that, but they've also had, as much as they, you know, their crappy games, they've had, you know, they had the Ninja Turtles license, or they had the Ninja Turtles license. They've had the Rabbids minigame collection. Just Dance, which is a monster hit. So they've kind of always balanced it between the two, because, you know, like, if one year is bad for like Assassin's Creed, they have Just Dance, and if Just Dance ever falls, they have like Assassin's Creed to kind of hold them up. If they both are at the same time, you know, they probably still have some type of B-level franchise that can keep them afloat for a bit until that next hit comes out. EA is kind of in the same boat where they're trying to find those franchises, but they haven't really found one that connected yet. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think a lot of companies, and you know, I've always hated saying that video games are cinematic, yada, 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 but I do think it's one of the attitudes that the game industry needs to take away from the movie industry, is the idea of a tentpole release, where you have like that one major movie, but with that one major movie, you kind of take risks, and you have these smaller projects around it to kind of help your bottom line and get those under.
Things that cost less and more likely to make profit.
Yeah, because, I mean, there's no reason why, you know, like, if you're putting all this money in, Call of Duty, that means you're money out.
It's an age old saying.
Yeah, you can kind of make other games that aren't, you know, as big of budget as Call of Duty. You kind of put them out, you give them a decent budget, you give them a push, and let's say it sells 500,000 copies to make back its budget instead of having to sell 3 million. And then you kind of, you know, most movie studios for the most part kind of succeed on this model. I'm not saying everybody works like on it. And some people, I mean, you know, it's a risk reward for any company. But this whole idea with the video game industry is that it's either boom or bust with a AAA title. There's not really any A or B tier titles anymore. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think we've done enough ranting for this week. Is there anything you folks want to say before we wrap?
Not particularly.
Not really.
Okay. Well, by the time this is up, our Final Fantasy poll should be done. As of right now, it's Final Fantasy IX in the lead, which I was actually kind of surprised about. I was even more surprised that Final Fantasy X is actually beating Final Fantasy VII.
Really?
Well, I've always... Final Fantasy VII's kind of held up in this light by a lot of people. I'm actually surprised that 13's the fifth place Final Fantasy, I don't know why, but yeah, either way, I'm going to try, hopefully, because I always say this, is that I'm going to, you know, I'll use it, and I'll write up the top 5 Final Fantasy games for the site, because usually we have these posts, and then they're done, and we never do anything with them. I figured, you know, share the results and stuff like that. You know, you can check us out on iTunes, give us reviews. I do appreciate feedback. Like I was told this week that I guess either, I don't know if it's in general or one episode in specific, the audio is really low, and somebody couldn't hear us, and, you know, the person told me this about 2 months after the fact. So, you know, I do appreciate feedback. It does help us improve the show and make it better. If you don't give it to us and you just say, you know, you just listen to it, like, whatever, that doesn't help anybody. So, you know, your reviews, I don't care if it's 1 star or 0 stars or 5 stars. I do appreciate feedback.
We'll do it.
Yeah, you know, we've gone through a lot of format changes. We've kind of, you know, fixed little things. We're trying as much as possible to keep these shows within an hour because people do get bored after a while, just don't have the time in the day. You can leave us, you know, if you can leave reviews on iTunes, you can leave comments on the show on the website. So yeah, there's that. most of this stuff, you know, I usually steal most of my stories from GameAndEverything.com, which is just like a catch-all website for gaming news. I would do N4G, but, you know, N4G has like 100 articles an hour, so it's really hard to just kind of get a recap for the week. I want to thank Daniel and Adam for joining us this week. This has been New World in episode 56.